Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, good evening. This is the LA Steel Show. Hold on one second here. I'm trying to. Unfortunately, I can't speak on the speakerphone tonight. Looks like. Yeah, tonight we have our guest is John Loftus, who is the author of America's Nazi Secret. And he's going to be talking. I've read the book, and I was quite impressed with it, and I had a number of questions to ask him tonight. But primarily, I wanted to commend him for bringing this forward to the public. It's quite a fascinating read, and it tells you that a lot of the culprits and the culpability of a number of agencies and individuals that brought thousands of Nazis over to our country and illegally and used them as spies and spy networks and so on. And many of this was all tolerated by the Justice Department right under the nose of Simon Wiesenthal, who was a Nazi hunter, you know. They thought everybody had sent him down to Chile and South America and Argentina, but in actuality, thousands of them came here under false identities, sponsored by the CIA and the early CIA and the Justice Department. So tonight I'm going to wait here for a moment until John calls in. He should be in at calling in at 8:05, and maybe I can do something here to get my phone back. Yeah, I'm not sure if I can if I can get this back on, but anyway, I'd like to until he gets here, we'll have to do the best we can. I just can't seem to knock that out. So anyway, tonight we're going to, like I said, we're going to talk to him as soon as he calls, and. John, read a little something about him here. Let's see. Let's read the first passage until he calls. Called the in the introduction. It says, "Let us begin at the beginning. I have already told a bit about myself in the original prologue to this book, so I will let stand what is written. What I did not say then was how very, very much I wanted to be a federal prosecutor. It is the only job for an honest lawyer, they said. You can always decide whether or not charges should be filed while defense counsel has to take every criminal who walks in the door. I wanted an honorable life, to be a priest at the Temple of the Justice." And he says, "I started as a law clerk under the Attorney General's Honor Program. And every year, a few bright young law students graduate are chosen from among thousands of applicants to work at the Department of Justice. In 1977, I entered Department of Justice headquarters, a monumental building in Washington, D.C., on Philadelphia Avenue, halfway between the White House and the Capitol. I was 27 years old when I was assigned to the Criminal Division, Appellate Section, and my office was on the second floor next to the Great Hall of Justice. Depression-era mosaics lined the walls and staircases depicting the famous lawgivers of history, from Hammurabi to the Prophet Muhammad. And on a certain stage in the famous statue of the Spirit of Justice, a semi-nude woman without blindfold on the scales of justice. Our Latin motto translates as, we who follow the Lady of Justice." And see. My new boss shook my hand and said, "Welcome to Justice Department, the Justice Department. You now represent the most corrupt client in the world, the United States government." I thought he was kidding, and I still think he was wrong. I did not work for the most corrupt client, just the most corrupt law firm. For nearly a century, Wall Street has made the Justice Department a principal target of acquisition. Huge corporate campaign donations come with a price, and the donors get to name the Attorney General, not always but often, who cannot buy the U.S. government, but the Justice Department is for rent. It is a very lucrative business. All right. And still waiting for John to call here, so I'm continuing to go. I hope he's okay. For nearly a year, Wall Street has made the Justice Department its principal target of acquisition. I already read that. The Environmental Crimes Unit at Justice can make or break corporate polluters. The tax division controls the IRS through binding interpretation of laws. And while the Congress passes the Refugee Relief Act in the 1950s, banning immigrants who supported totalitarian regimes, justices, INS, interpreted the ban to apply only to those who advocated a totalitarian regime in the United States. Thus, congressional intent to ban the immigration of those who had supported the regime of Hitler, Mussolini, or Tojo was simply reversed by Eisenhower's Attorney General. And instead of banning Nazi immigration, DOJ said the law legalized the immigration of former Nazis as long as they did not try to establish a Fourth Reich in America. And worse, that twisted interpretation was deployed to obstruct the Justice Department Nazi hunters 3 decades later. So we're going to talk to John Loftus here right now. I see him on the line. Oops. Hello, John. You with us?
Yes. Good evening, Leo.
Hey, John.
Hello.
How are you?
Yes,
can you hear me? Yeah.
Yes, you're fine.
Yeah. How are you doing? How's the weather now? Is it still comfortable?
It's 40. Yeah, it's 40. 70 degrees up.
Oh, it's still 70 degrees? Oh, that's good. That's good. What's that?
Somebody has to live in Florida.
I know. It's a pain. But I don't envy you in the summer, though, I swear. I wanted to, I was really happy to have you come back on the show tonight after we had an interview on Tuesday. And there were several areas that I wanted to discuss further with you that we didn't get time to discuss on the show. And that was, one was the rise of the Arab Nazis, which are basically Al-Qaeda, you're saying, and how they developed, how they were fine-tuned into this strange brotherhood now and now are menacing the entire world, according to the CIA. Can you explain that for us, John?
Sure. Back in 1928, there was an Egyptian admirer of Adolf Hitler. His name was Hassan al-Banna. And he established the Muslim Brotherhood as sort of an Arab Nazi movement. And eventually it had nearly 750,000 members.
Wow.
And their motto was, "In heaven, Allah, on earth, Hitler." Now, the ambassador from the Muslim Brotherhood was a Palestinian who was Hitler's favorite Arab. It was the Haj Amin al-Husseini. He was the...
we're breaking up a little bit here. Hey, can you still hear me? Hello? John? I think we lost John. Um, John, if you can hear me, you might want to, could you please call back into the station and just hang up? Okay, see, we've just been disconnected, okay. Hopefully you'll be able to call back. So anyway, right now I just have absolute dead air, so I'm assuming that the show is still running. Yeah, sorry that that Johnny, we lost Johnny. Hopefully his battery went dead. Or I know he was talking from a cell phone on the outside. He doesn't have a landline where he is, and I was hoping to get a better reception here tonight. No, he hasn't called back. Okay. Let's see. Without John to explain the format of it, it's almost it's very difficult to for me to criticize it because it's I had so many questions after I read the book that I was profoundly affected by it for several days, the information, and trying to rationalize to some degree how someone could think that the immigration of these horrible killers, these horrible murderers, where it was allowed by the United States government, in fact encouraged, and by the subterranean government that operates, such as the CIA, you know, and all the covert operations around the world. So we went out and settled out and went out and recruited all of these Nazi spies to help us, who all the Nazi spies who also worked for the as agents for against the Soviet Union. We were able to bring over to our side so that they could work as double agents. Well, some of these were working as triple agents, and that's how they stayed alive. So it was like, you know, these were dangerous times, very dangerous times, and there were massive actions by all governments around the world to capture these criminals, and there were many of them were living in separate, you know, false lives, you know, false identities, different witness placement programs and stuff like that, so they could be buried in society and not, you know, and not surface. So those were areas that were quite. They all had to be involved here, deep in central government of the United States, in order for them to be adequately compensated, if you will. In other words, get on the payroll. So as the book progresses, he talks in great deal about the, of course, the Polaris files, which are how they imported these Holocaust guards and murderers in the Belarusian area during World War II. Was the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. Their first area that they came into was Belarus, and that area belonging to the Belarusians, or the White Russians, politically White Russians groups, which were formerly the Tsar, and the Tsar's military against the Red Russians, which were the communist military, and they fought a bloody civil war. So these members got together down in the southern part of Russia near the Ukraine, and that was the in the Belarusian area, and settled there. And developed their own their own government, if you will. And the president of that Belarusian council, all right, was the president of the also was a major war criminal, all right, who killed thousands and countless number of Jews, Poles, and other nationalities in merciless killings with you know, they dig open pits and then throw as many as 5,000 people in those ditches and just kill them, all afternoon of killing, you know, and slaughter. So it was like, these people were the overseers of that. And, you know, they became supposedly valuable aides, which was later proven not to be, because they were lying mostly about everything that they were telling us. So, as spies. However, the Justice Department allowed them in, even though they were notoriously wanted war criminals. He also talks about the Nuremberg trials being fixed, and how these certain people would escape, all the people that were wanted. And, of course, you got to remember that the Soviet Union, as well as the United States, were soliciting these people to work for them to avoid the Nuremberg trials and possible life imprisonment or death. So they didn't have much of an option. So what they did is they jumped the fence and went over to the Russian side, and then when the opportunity came, the Nazi side, and then. And then the United States side. So this is how it goes, and this is how these things were done. And John wrote a book in, here he is. He's just back with us. Okay, hang on a second.
Hello,
John, are you with us? Hi, I lost you.
Yes, I am. I'm sorry for the drop call. NSA must be playing games with my phone.
Ah, probably. Well, I got AT&T too, so I'll blame it on mine. I read a portion of your introduction to them, to the audience as well, and I was just discussing the significance of what you published, as well as the heinous crimes that were committed by these people during the Holocaust there and during the Nazi invasion. My question, maybe we can start off, since I've given a pretty good introduction to your book. The one character, the one area I wanted to mention was this Arab Brotherhood, all right, and the and why everywhere in the world, all right, all other countries have them on their terror list, and the United States, I believe it's Israel. The United States and Israel, or just the United States that has them not on the terror?
Just the United States. Israel and every Arab country list the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist group.
They did too.
Our State Department actually had a couple of guys spending taxpayers' dollars publishing papers saying the Muslim Brotherhood were really moderates, people we could work with. Completely asinine.
Right.
And the Justice Department turns a blind eye.
Yeah. You know,
we refuse to list the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist group, despite the fact that its member organizations are Hamas, Egyptian Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Al-Qaeda. You don't get any worse than that.
Yeah. Hey, see, my question is, how could they have possibly converted Nazism into Muslim? That kind of extremist brotherhood. How is that converted?
Well, think about it. The philosophies are pretty much the same. They both
hated
Western democracy. They hated Christians and Jews.
Yeah.
You know, the Muslim Brotherhood, their motto was "In heaven, Allah; on earth, Hitler." And the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, back in 1928, used to correspond with Hitler.
Hitler founded the Muslim Brotherhood.
And his ambassador to Hitler was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. And Hitler personally briefed this guy on the Holocaust. Hitler's aide said, "How can you tell this Arab this top secret program?" And Hitler said, "Because they support us so enthusiastically."
Wow.
So the Muslim Brotherhood were working hand-in-hand with the Third Reich, with their intelligence service. And as soon as Cairo was taken by General Rommel, they were going to have the SS mobile killing units come down and start wiping out all the Jews in North Africa and Israel.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, I could see why they were excited about that. Wow. So our long-lasting friendship here with them appears to be eternal or what? I mean, is it going to last? This is something that they obviously don't ever or never will see, never put them. I guess they'll never put them on our terror list. Is that the way it looks?
Well, I think it will eventually, because there's an awful lot of people in the intelligence community that are starting to realize the State Department has just been blowing smoke. The Vice President of the United States, Vice President Bush, used the Muslim Brotherhood to recruit the Mujahideen for Afghanistan back in the 80s when we threw the Russians up. And, we've had links with these guys for a long time. CIA doesn't know it. Congress doesn't know it. But, terrorist hunters around the world know exactly who the Muslim Brotherhood is. They're not nice guys.
Well, I don't understand with all this intelligence why the CIA or the other agencies wouldn't know that, you know?
Well, the CIA, historically, spent a lot of their time hunting Nazi groups, and I documented that, for example, in my recent book about right. America's Nazi Secret, how they were chasing the Ukrainian Nazis while the Justice Department and State were bringing them in.
Yeah.
And the CIA bent over backwards to keep these people out of the country. The same with the Muslim Brotherhood. The CIA wanted nothing to do with them. That's why the whole Afghanistan Mujahideen operation was run out of Vice President Bush's office in the White House to circumvent the CIA.
Wow. So how, where does that lead us? Is that, I mean, in other words, I'm sorry, go ahead. What did you say?
We have a government split right down the middle. We've got two agencies, state and justice, following their own foreign policy. Regardless of whether Republicans or Democrats are in office, they're doing what they want.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's just so ridiculous. It's like they're running their own little business. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. God. So how do we clean this out? How does this ever get cleaned out?
Leo, that's a great question. There's two approaches. One is a special prosecutor, because you can't allow the Justice Department to investigate itself. It's a conflict of interest. So appoint a special prosecutor, or, like they did in South Africa, have some sort of congressional truth hearings. Bring everybody up, put them under oath, and let them talk about what they did.
Right.
And I don't care if you pardon them all, but we've got to clean this cancer out of government.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you.
It's Veterans Day, and on Veterans Day, we're talking about how, to this day, you know, state and justice
it would be a good interview for Veterans Day, because there's so many guys fighting and dying for this, you know, and it's, I don't know, it's so hard to explain. Have you ever read the War is a Racket by Smedley, General Smedley Butler?
General Smedley Butler, yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah,
great
guy, yeah. You read his book, right, War is a Racket?
I read portions of it. I don't think I read the whole book, but
it's real small. Yeah, it's a very small book, but it indicts all of the military and the corporations, and so he says war is a racket to enrich the corporations. He comes right out and says it there in that book, and he was the guy that was responsible for the tipping off the FDR the takeover by these corporations and by the Rockefellers and so on. All these industrialists got together and wanted to take over the government.
I wonder how many people even realize that American corporations once tried to overthrow the president of the United States and install an army general as the dictator. You know?
Yep.
It almost happened, but luckily General Butler was an honest man.
Yeah, Smedley said he wouldn't have anything to do with that, you know, and he called them out for the crooks that they are. And, you know, I admired him greatly, and there's so few people that could have done that, you know what I mean? I appreciate what you're doing by bringing this information out, and, hopefully we can enlighten a few people as to the complicity and the corruption of our government. In these matters.
The sad thing is, most of the people in government that I've met, you know, are good and decent folks. But what's happened is the corporations have figured out you can't buy the U.S. government, but you can rent the Justice Department. And once you rent the Justice Department, that's how you fix everything. You can fix the interpretation of the tax laws, bring Nazis into the country, whatever you want to do. Once you control justice, and nobody goes to jail.
You got it. But it was a sad tale, really, your book, because the probably the most vivid picture I got from it was your description of the I don't know if it was your description or the CIA description. I believe it was yours of the how what was it. In the Belarusian in Belarus, they had the horrible
killing squads, the Sardine method of execution. Yeah. They would actually force the Jews.
5,000 people or something. It was absolutely a horrendous image,
You know, the worst part about that was after the war, they had autopsies on the victims. They couldn't find any wounds upon the smallest children, apparently to save the price of a bullet. They buried the babies alive.
Yeah, and people were crawling out of those pits, and even as you said that even the SS were shocked at the barbarity of the slaughter. You know what I mean?
They actually wrote letters back to Berlin, protesting how these massacres were carrying out, saying it nauseated the German soldiers that had to witness them. Can you imagine that? Bad enough to nauseate the SS.
Yeah, enough to nauseate the SS. I mean that'll tell you something, but it's like you know I was appalled at some of the images that you had in there, and it really I have to be honest, it disturbed me for quite a few days. However, I was compelled to keep on reading for some reason, and I found that probably the most cynical and yet the most very, very, very cynical, but extremely interesting area in the book was where you were in the graveyard, all right? Of the you were reading the
headstones. South River, New Jersey. Yeah. They had a private cemetery.
That was great writing, by the way. I really enjoyed that section.
Thank you.
You know, it was like it was good. You know, you really took you right there, and you could see it. And then the guard, the description of the guy that came in. That guard was almost like Frankenstein walking in there or something, you know. You know the guy who caught you in the graveyard there?
Oh yeah. It was a terrifying moment.
Yeah, he was frightening looking.
My wife wasn't too pleased with me, Leo, when she found out what I did.
what did you say?
My wife was not too pleased when she found out.
I'm sure she wasn't too pleased. Yeah, my God. That was taking it in your But you know do you remember the old detective movies? There was a guy who I loved him. I don't know if he's still alive, but he used to do that. Was it Kolchak or something?
Kolchak.
No, not Telly Savalas. The other guy. He used to do all these. It reminded me of a scene from those television shows. Where he'd always wind up getting involved with something that was spooky, you know, and but it was so cool. I could almost see you in a hat and the in a detective hat there, you know, from the 50s.
Oh, Sergeant Friday.
It looked like it was great. I just loved the scene, and I loved the suspense, but I loved the. The way you took care of that scene, it was very, very good. I appreciate it. I write too, and I could understand. I could see the inspiration there. It was great, you know. But especially a tag to this remarkable story, you know, and to see the irony, the sick irony of the whole situation, you know.
So now the Justice Department has a real problem.
Yeah.
Because they classified this stuff 30 years ago. How can they now say it's not true?
Yeah.
You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. I mean, you punched them right in the nose. And,
Leo? How can they now say that it's not true if they classified this stuff 30 years ago?
Yeah.
So the time clock has run out. They're in deep trouble.
Oh, absolutely there. Absolutely there. And
just wanted to live long enough to make sure that the book got out.
Well, a lot of those guys, I bet some of those guys are 75, 80-year-old retirees, wondering what's going to happen there.
There's a lot of Justice Department bureaucrats that are wondering what's going to happen.
That's what I'm saying. Well, you got to even wonder if any of those guys are still living, the guys that you wrote about back then. And I remember you said that they're about 8 Reagan's age, so they'd be damn near 100 now. But the legacy is still there, and very strong in that neighborhood. Yeah.
Oh, you know what's funny?
New Jersey,
old Nazi hunting unit that I work for, the OSI, is now hunting Arab terrorists in America. What a joke!
It's a total joke. Total joke. And it's just almost like I don't know. It's almost like the way you describe these agencies. It's just like they all have little helicopters on their head, little helicopter hats, you know, and they're buzzing around the room, you know, not knowing what one is doing or the other is doing. They're just buzzing around. It's like I also interviewed another co-author there from your, not a co-author, but another author published from Douglas Valentine. And he was talked about the strength of the pack, and he was talking about the development of the DEA and how the CIA was involved with that and how one hand washed the other. And, I mean, nobody knew what the other guy was doing, you know what I mean? It was just, it sounds exactly like what you had to go through, you know, shuffling through those files. And he interviewed a number of CIA people for his book. But
I wish we were smarter than that. You know, it seems to be
the chaos, the
90%
chaos of it. Absolutely.
The only ones that knew what they were doing were the Russian intelligence service and the multinational corporations that were making money off both sides.
That's right. That's right. And they had everybody else so bamboozled. Nobody knew what the hell was going on. And it's just a remarkable display of absolute insanity in the government. So what can we do now? What can we do to get to clean this up somehow? What are your recommendations to getting government to listen to us here?
Well, I think what you're going to have to do is everybody has to get their congressmen to start having hearings again. I mean, I made an overwhelming case in the book that the congressional hearings were fixed.
Nuremberg. Oh, absolutely, you did. Yeah.
You know,
don't
we owe it to our World War II veterans and to the Holocaust survivors before they pass away to let them know that there were Nazis in America and there's some corrupt American officials and some corrupt businessmen let them in.
Yeah.
It may be too late for justice, but it's not too late for the truth.
No, absolutely not. And I commend you for getting this out. And I love that the idea that the tenacity that you had to continue with this. But I really enjoyed reading that part about you fishing through the archives and how Jimmy Carter assigned you to the position there, I guess, or you volunteered, I guess it was,
Yeah, I volunteered. I thought it would just, you know, I might get a free trip to Germany out of it, you know. I had no idea that I would end up in these giant underground vaults. Leo, did you ever see that movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark?
The last
scene of that movie is what the vaults are really like, only not as organized as they were in the movie.
Not as organized, right? There's
20 acres of vaults underground, 20 acres of top secret vaults.
Oh, my God. 20 acres. You can't even imagine what's in those, you know what I mean? Like they say, the ark is in there, you know, or something. You know, you just have no idea. So, it must have been amazing. Did you see anything else that was that was marked like anything of interest in those crates or in those vaults?
Oh yeah, I came across the UFO files. It was a riot. In fact, I actually had a Q clearance for nuclear weapons and I bumped into this nice old scientist, and he told me the whole story, that right after World War II, we were afraid the Russians were going to make an atomic bomb. And the only way we had to spy on them was these three-story tall silver balloons, and we'd float them over the U.S., over the Atlantic, over Russia, and they had Geiger counters and tape recorders attached. One day, this is a true story, one of the top secret spy balloons crashed in Roswell, New Mexico.
Whoa.
And, you know, and people look at the balloon going, hey, someone in the crowd said it looks like a flying saucer. And a very smart Army captain grabbed up all the pieces of the fabric and the equipment, and he spread the rumor that a flying saucer had crashed in Roswell, New Mexico, and the U.S. Army was covering it up. And that's the story the papers ran with the next day, and the Russians paid no attention. Now, why we kept flying those balloons over Russia from 1945 to 1952 when we replaced them with the U-2 spy plane.
Wow. That's amazing.
So that's how the UFO story got started.
So what are UFOs then? There's still a lot of them out there.
It was such a good cover story. What happened is we built flying saucers. We had a company up in Canada called Avro Aviation, A-V-R-O, and they built this miniature flying saucer. It was going to be sort of like a small Jeep, if you will, that would fly at low levels, but they could never fix the steering. So the Pentagon took over the contract, and we actually made the stupid thing fly. And its job was to buzz civilian airplanes and military jets, and all these sober pilots would swear that they saw flying saucers. Well, the idea was it was all government deception. It was a cover story to hide the fact that we were doing advanced weapons training. For example, Saddam Hussein never knew that we had invisible stealth aircraft until one day all of his radars blew up at the same time.
Oh, geez.
So the whole UFO story was a brilliant deception to hide weapons testing. There really is an Area 51, by the way, Leo, but it's the most polluted place on the planet. I mean,
that's
where we had... Yeah, we made the goop for the stealth fighters there. It's this goop that we spread on the wings to hide. And I think over 103 civilians have died at the plant so far.
Oh, my God.
So that's why the plant is totally out of bounds.
Oh, my God. But they still got people willing to work there?
If there are UFOs now... We'd never know it because this deception program went on for so long. How would anybody know the truth at this point?
Wow, yeah. Well, no, I know that, you know, sorry. I know that Roswell is still quite a place, and they still claim to have those pictures and everything else of alien beings and whatnot that crashed. And supposedly the 1952... President Eisenhower, one of his first things he did was create some kind of a treaty with the aliens, and that's how they got the science and the rocket science and all this kind of stuff. The reason I'm bringing these up, John, is because I do on my Friday night programs. I have a friend of mine who's a researcher in many of these areas, and we discuss this. But as far as the UFOs are concerned, he actually is a researcher and has conducted many, many interviews with UFO abductees. And he says that they're real. He says they are real. He says these people really experience things that can't really be explained. So.
I do know that my guess is that like 95% of the UFOs that people have seen are ones that we built in the U.S.
It wouldn't surprise me. But let's say this, for instance, this thing that blew up in California, they thought it was a rocket or something over the airport, and yet and they denied it and said no, it was just an unusual chemtrail from a regular plane that was taking off, and it just happened to be in that light, but it wasn't a missile. But they're still not, they weren't sure. I read this article when it came up the other day about it. And they're not sure if they're thinking it could have been a missile. It looked like the flight path of a missile.
You know what? I did something like that. There was allegedly a missile fired off the coast of New York City that shot down a plane. But a missile that was fired would have to have been picked up on radar. And there were lots of planes with their own radar, even ships, and nobody saw a missile trail. So I think this time I tend to believe the vapor trail story.
Yeah, that could be. It sounded plausible to me, but I wasn't sure. But you mentioned the one that off the New York Harbor there. was in, you know, flight 188.
Yeah, I still keep an open mind about that because there's so many unanswered questions about that one.
Well, I can I can tell you quite frankly because I interviewed this the author and she wrote this book called Into the Buzzsaw, and she was the producer for CBS producer for what's his name, Dan Rather. She worked with Dan Rather.
Yes.
And well, when he was working with CBS at that time. And she put together a news piece on that, and it turned out that there was a great piece, she found evidence to support that it was a rocket that hit that, and it was one of our rockets that hit it, all right? And because they hid that immediately. Once she took the whole thing to CBS with the interviews and the documents and the evidence, she was told that they wouldn't run it. You know, they would not run that piece because you know, the FBI came in and told them to stop everything, the running of it, and they wanted them to can the whole documentary. So she said that then she was fired, all right, from CBS, and they replaced her and the senior top guy, okay, at CBS News, with somebody who from the FBI. They put an FBI guy right in there, so that none of this stuff would be cleaned out. And shoot, this book, this great book, it's called Into the Buzzsaw,
yeah.
And it documented how these reporters are censored, and these reports are completely crushed by the FBI or CIA.
I used to have to submit all of my books for censorship. It would go to CIA, and then they would staff them around the agencies. But then I got a letter this time from CIA saying, you know, for the first time in 30 years, you don't have to submit any more books for censorship. So I said, great. So I put everything into this book that was censored out over the last 30 years.
Wow.
So,
yeah, you know what I was surprised at? I was surprised that... Not to diminish Trine Day at all. In fact, you know, I praise them as a publisher. But you know, did you submit this revision to Knopf, who was your first publisher for the Belarus Files?
You know what? I had talked about it with a number of houses, and they just didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the reason is, but. And so Trine Day said, hey, you know, we'll do whatever you want to write, we'll do. So I sat down and wrote out the new introduction and the new epilogue, and it ended up to be almost a whole new book.
But I was very surprised. I mean, I don't know, were you surprised that that Knopf wasn't interested anymore in doing your book?
Yeah, I think that...
They did,
it was their nominee for the Pulitzer Prize in history when it first came out 30
years.
But
that's why I would
think
they would have been, though.
The publishing industry has gone broke, you know,
yeah.
And most American houses are owned by the Bertelsmann's group out of Germany. They just don't do advances. So I basically, you know, wrote the book on a $1,000 advance from Trinebit and said, you know, it was just sort of a gift to the American people. But I am appalled at how little press attention it's getting. I mean, this is well-documented things where the U.S. Justice Department lied to Congress. We had Nazis coming in the country. They covered it up, the connection with the Muslim Brotherhood. Just the wiretapping. I mean, my God, these guys have found a way to wiretap American citizens without search warrants.
That's right.
Without a single one.
That's right. That's right. I mean, they've destroyed us in all these ways. I mean, I have no, no illusions or delusions that I'm not being our program is out there. Our programs are everywhere on the internet, and they're out on for years. And I've got everything that I've done in archive, so all the interviews that we've done over the years. But I wouldn't have any doubt that possibly my phone, my private phones, maybe bugged, you know what I mean, or things like that. I mean, not that I can tell, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me, you know, because we've been on the air and we've been extremely anti-government for you know, all those years. So what do you think, that you are being tapped or being surveyed or whatever?
It doesn't surprise me at all, but I keep a sense of humor about it, Leo.
I know. It doesn't surprise you because you just kind of know. I had a friend of mine who was a celebrity. I won't mention his name, but he is a rock singer. But he once asked for his, because of his involvement with so many causes, he once asked for the Freedom of Information file on him himself, you know, and he was absolutely floored at how much information they had on him, all right, and you know, he advised me to get mine done, and I hadn't even, I mean, this was very early before we had really developed the radio show too much. I think it was in the first year of the show, but he said, get one done on yourself, Leo, because he says, I guarantee. And, you know, I've always wanted to do that, but I've been afraid to. Isn't that weird?
Haven't bothered to either. I just figure, and my life's an open book. They can get whatever they want. But it's amazing.
I've got to believe that, too. But it's like, you know, I feel that way because as a public figure, you do that. As, you know, your whole thing is to attract people to buy your book or to buy your, you know, listen to your show or something, you know. So we have a different attitude about it. But as a private citizen, you know, knowing all the details of your dirty life, you wonder if they got pictures of you back in 1969 or something, you know. I had a friend of mine. Yeah, I had another broadcast friend of mine that told me the story, and I never forgot it, because he said it scared the hell out of him. Because back in 1972 or 73, he was marching in an anti Vietnam War protest, you know. And he's a broadcaster; he was on radio for a number of years, and he said that you know, because he was probably in his 20s then, and he said that he didn't realize that he had any kind of record or anything of being, you know, because he was just a regular guy, you know. And he said one day they called him up on the phone and said I'd asked, you know, and told him that they were the CIA or the CIA or FBI, and he said that they wanted to they needed him to do something, or there was something that they were they were questioning him over the phone. That said, are you they actually called him at work and said, are you such and such? And he says, yes, I am. And she says, do you realize that we have pictures of you marching in the anti-war protest in 1973 in D.C.? And he says no. He says, what, you really do? He says, yeah. And he says, yes, we do. And he says, we're following up on your activities, okay? So the guy was really shocked, you know, right out of the blue. He gets that, but he asked for proof that they had that. So they told him they described what he was wearing over the phone to him in that picture, and he remembered because it was only like about a year before or something, and he said,
wow.
They described him to the T, what he looked like, what he was wearing, and where he was walking, and it just freaked him out. And so, you know, you just never know. And here's a guy that all he did was just walk in an anti-war parade, but they told him that they had records on everybody who was in that rally. And he said, Leo, there was 200,000-400,000 people down there, you know. So I've been to a number of rallies and have done documentaries on them and filmed them and interviewed the speakers and student things like that. But I haven't been, and I put them on television and so on, but I haven't had any overt notification of their covering me like he did, you know. Have you had any overt...
Yeah, that's pretty bizarre. It looked like they were trying to recruit an informant and trying to scare him into cooperating. But,
yeah,
you know, when
I went
after the Army...
Yeah, like, well, Ryan wouldn't have anything to do with that. He says, look, you don't scare me, he says, because all I'm doing is I don't want to do anything. He says, I didn't do anything. All I did is my legal right. And he says, and he says, if you're going to press charges on me for something, I said, do it, but don't try to harass me, you know. And I appreciated the way this guy handled it. And he got off his back, I was very surprised, Dan.
A lot of very crazy things done in the 70s that have since been made illegal. Although, from what I saw when I was in the Justice Department in the 80s, they made them legal again. All they do is they ask British intelligence to bug a phone, and the British do it for us. And
yeah, right.
It's the whole American court system.
It doesn't matter because I remember reading that Israel... Actually, there is a company, an Israeli-owned company in this country, that all the phone every phone call in this country goes through. Okay, before it's sent out, it's a relay kind of company. So it's all done. So everything goes through this company, and the CIA actually found. That labeled it as a potential spy unit, and wanted to crack the place, but they were told not to by the president. This was under George Bush actually, but they were given immunity to any kind of investigation.
What happens is that the Israeli stuff is very small. Most of the wiretapping is done in the United States by Canada and second by Great Britain. The Israelis would be way, way distant, tiny.
Yeah.
They make some of the equipment that the phone companies use. Maybe that's where the confusion arose.
There actually is a company, a phone company, a huge percentage. I don't know if it's all of it or 95% of it of all the phone calls are routed through that company. All right.
I think what it is that they make the relays that are used in 95% of phone calls, but no one company in America gets 95% of the phone calls. There are about 25
some kind of a relay. They got all the phone calls from everyone. It's just kind of it's a relay kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Every time you make a long distance phone call, it goes through a microwave relay tower, and every day, every microwave phone call gets automatically recorded, all of them, because the vacuum cleaner approach, and then the computers then sift through and search through all those millions of phone calls to find the sound of your voice. So that's called targeting. Now, what Congress did was to ban targeting of American citizens without warrants. Justice Department rewrote the law to say banning targeting by the NSA. And so that meant that what Congress didn't know it, but they had authorized targeting by the British. Another one of those little backdoor deals that Justice did. But I couldn't believe it. I'm in the Attorney General's archives in Washington reading how they actually rewrote a law and stuck it by Congress without them knowing it to continue illegal wiretapping.
I got to just interrupt for 1 second. We're running out of time on the show here, on the stream part of the show. And you can call in at 646-915-9505 in the next 10 seconds, and you can stay on listening to our program. But our live stream will be going in about 5 seconds, so I want to thank everybody for listening, and please we will be recording a little more on this program that you can pick up in our archives. Okay, John, thank you for holding there.
You're quite welcome.
mention that to our listeners. But I think the I lost my train of thought here as to where we were before.
Well, we talked about warrantless wiretapping and how sharp that was.
Warrantless wiretapping.
The Justice Department had rewritten the law so that American citizens could be bugged by British intelligence using American computers. And then, you know, overseas, Americans use British computers to bug British citizens. And then we each swap information. So,
it's
amazing that
it's so incestuous, you know. It's like one big coiling snake, you know what I mean, with 100 tentacles. it just doesn't get, everything's connected and, but I'm hoping someday we can break through this, and I think what your book did is help in that way. And for those of you listening, it's America's Stasi Secret, and that's written by John Loftus. And John, I really enjoyed having you on for the hour. It went by very fast.
Well, Leo, thank you very much. I enjoyed it too. Take care now.
Okay. Good luck. Bye bye. And I want to thank everybody who's joined us tonight. And please tell your friends if you like the interview. And again, that was John Loftus, the author of America's Nazi Secret. And tomorrow night, please join us. We have George Dixon coming on tomorrow, and we're going to be wrapping up the new year here, or the old year. Be talking about the Mayan calendar and where we're going with that, and what the recent events are related to that great moment in time, which is the end of the seventh day, and that's coming up real soon. So I want to brace everybody for that show. So tune in tomorrow, same time, 8 o'clock, 8 to 9, with George Dixon, right here on ALA Steel Show. And good night.